Up next, Dr. Jerry Brown joins us. We are going to talk about the psychedelic gospels, the secret history of hallucinogens in Christianity. A fascinating story. I also wrote the book with Julie Brown. So we'll be back with Jerry in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We've got a fascinating couple hours here for you. Dr. Jerry Brown with us, PhD. He's an anthropologist, author, activist from 1972 to 2014. Served as a founding professor of anthropology at Florida International University in Miami. Taught a course on hallucinogens and culture. Currently, he directs the World Business Academy Save Energy Project, calling for the rapid transition to 100% renewable energy. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Jerry, welcome to the program. Happy holidays to you.
The very same to you. Good morning.
And am I assuming that Julie M. Brown, of course, is related to you somehow?
She is my wife.
Super.
My wife and co-author.
Makes it easy to collaborate on a book that way, doesn't it?
It's a lot easier to get together.
It is. Hey, let me just take a few minutes and ask you about your push for renewable energy. Fascinating. I hope you succeed because I think it's very important to all of us. But where do we stand right now? What's going on in that arena?
Well, where we stand is there's a couple of drivers there, obviously climate change, but I think the biggest driver of all is the decreasing cost of photovoltaics and wind, which are competitive with fracked shale natural gas. So what we've seen is, as opposed to the 1970s under Carter, where we sort of got a false start during the Iranian Revolution, the Arab-Israeli War, and the oil boycotts, right now over $5 trillion have been invested in renewable energy worldwide since the last 5 years. So this is now the real deal. Certain states like New York and California have very aggressive programs moving to, especially in California, to 50% renewable energy. And in a place like Germany, which is phasing out all of its nuclear power plants in the aftermath of Fukushima,
yeah,
there's only one industry that employs more people, if we're going to talk about jobs and the renewable energy future, than renewable energy, and that's the auto industry. So this is here to stay, and it is all technologically feasible. It's really the political will to move in this direction over time. And as oil becomes, we're looking at long time frames. As oil has to be phased out or becomes just too expensive to get, natural gas goes through its cycle. We're going to see a global renewable energy future, and hydrogen is going to be part of a key to that as well.
And we've got it available, don't we? There's lots of it. It's in abundance.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's enough sun that falls on the earth, in an hour to power our needs. It's really a question of capturing it.
That's
and what
right.
Most people don't realize that this the photovoltaic effect, where the energy comes out of when the sun's rays strike a photoelectric cell. This was Einstein again. He developed the photoelectric effect, in which these electrons are released when the sun's energy strikes certain substances. So here we are, and it's going to be a transition, I believe, to a hydrogen-based economy, hydrogen being the most plentiful element in the universe, and hydrogen fuel cells, which can provide base load 24/7 stationary power, will become part of that future, along with wind, with geothermal, and of course with solar.
Might happen sooner than later too, huh, Jerry?
Well, it's all been happening faster than most people have realized or imagined, and the rate at which the cost, and that obviously becomes a key factor, that photoelectric cells and wind power has declined, has kind of surprised everyone. It's kind of like computer memory. You know, once the volume starts kicking in and the economics of scale start being applied, these costs can drop dramatically.
All right, let's talk about the book, The Psychedelic Gospels. Tell me about that, how you approached it, how you even thought about it.
Well, I first started looking into psychedelics and hallucinogens after my very first LSD trip at something called a Rainbow Family Gathering, sort of an early Burning Man high in the mountains of Colorado. And it was a pretty traumatic experience for me. And as I reflected on it, I said, you know, there's something very powerful here. There's something that can, you know, people are talking about instant enlightenment. I certainly didn't experience that. Kind of went in the other direction. But I, as an academic, I wanted to learn more about it. So I designed and taught a course on hallucinogens and culture, starting back in the mid-70s, and I taught it continuously till I retired from Florida International University in 2014. Then, in 2006, on a honeymoon trip to Scotland, Julie and I visited Roslyn Chapel, which we were drawn to from Dan Brown's famous novel, The Da Vinci Code.
That's right.
Because he had mentioned Roslyn Chapel in the book as one of the possible resting places of the Holy Grail. And at Roslyn, I discovered, sculpted into the head of the most prominent green man, because Roslyn is a synthesis of pagan and Catholic symbols, although it is a Catholic church, an Amanita mushroom, a psychoactive Amanita mushroom, that red and white dotted mushroom that you see on Christmas cards.
That looks like Santa Claus, doesn't it?
Yeah, you see it associated with Santa Claus and Scandinavian folk tales. You'll find it in, a lot of the younger people find it in Super Mario game, because it's by, getting the mushroom, they get their power to go on to save Princess Toadstool. So after that, my head started spinning, because first of all, I said, why had no one discovered this for, 500 years?
Right.
Since this was sitting there in Roslyn Chapel, which has been investigated and studied every which way. It's been associated with the Knights Templar. It's been associated as a resting place of the Holy Grail, and many other mysteries surround it. And my head started spinning, and I said, wow, what is Sir William St. Clair, who designed and built Roslyn from about, 1540 till 1440 to 1480s when he died, what was he trying to tell us? Are we going to find more of this in Christian art? And I said, what does this mean for early Christianity, even for the life of Jesus? And then the words of Carl Sagan, the famous astrophysicist, kicked in. And the words were, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And to say that psychoactive plants, particularly magic mushrooms, were involved in early Christianity is certainly an extraordinary claim. So Julie and I decided to set out and do a study and travel to churches and cathedrals and abbeys and chapels throughout Europe and the Middle East to see if we could find other evidence of psychedelics in Christian art. And by that, I mean in frescoes, illuminated Bibles, stained glass windows as in Chartres Cathedral, mosaics, and in the 9 churches and cathedrals, all the way to the obscure cave churches of Turkey, where early Christians fled as early as the first century, we found the evidence. And at a certain point, we had George, this aha moment where we said, this is an alternative gospel. This is a psychedelic gospel encoded in the artwork, because back in the 6th century, the Pope said, art will be the Bible of the illiterate. And most people, most of the masses were illiterate throughout the Middle Ages. So we were saying, well, here in the Bible of the masses is another gospel. It's different from the Gnostic Gospels. It's different from the Gospels of the New Testament. And we decided to put forth this theory of the role of psychedelics in Christian art.
Did the role of psychedelics enhance their abilities? Let's say even Jesus, his ability to do these incredible miracles that we've heard so much about?
Well, that is a very interesting question, and let me just back into it. First of all, while we have compelling evidence of psychedelics in Christian art, in other words, very clear, distinct visual evidence of psychedelics in, for example, St. Michael's Church in Hildesheim, Germany, where the artwork by the bishop who created it is so clear that ethnobotanists, people who study plants in different cultures, can actually tell the variety of mushroom, of psychoactive psilocybin mushroom that's being drawn there. There is no visible Christian art, datable Christian art, before 200, for a lot of reasons. Early Christians were Jews, do not make graven images. Mm-hmm. It requires institutions to create art. So we had to go back and look into look into the Gospels of the New Testament, and into the Gnostic Gospels to reinterpret them within this framework of psychedelic art. And we found that a lot of the enigmatic sayings of Jesus, which I'll come back to in a little while, a lot of those sayings, it makes sense. For example, eat of my flesh, drink of my blood. Well, Jesus certainly wasn't advocating cannibalism, which would be repugnant to Christians and Jews and Romans alike. So what did it mean? We believe it meant he was telling people to eat of the mushroom or to drink of the juice of the mushroom. But related to healing, it's very interesting. In Canterbury Cathedral, there's a very famous illuminated Bible that has ended up in Napoleon's hands and was placed in the National Library of France. And it has, on many of its gorgeous illustrations, images of magic mushrooms, of psychoactive mushrooms. For example, on the very first page illustrating Genesis, there's a magnificent image of God creating plants, which is on the cover of our book, The Psychedelic Gospels. And actually, God is creating four psychoactive plants. And it's very clear from that, because when you go on a little bit more in the Bible, you see other kinds of plants, which are obviously green plants, as opposed to the psychedelic mushrooms. Well, to get further on, and we have no smoking gun proof of this, but obviously marijuana has tremendous healing properties. Other plants have healing properties. And throughout shamanism, the first religion of our hunting and gathering ancestors, these plants were used. One of their primary uses was in healing. Well, there in one of the illustrations, in the scene called The Healing of the Leper, there's Jesus, and he has his hands on the head of the leper. And the scrolls, which are written in the Latin, he says, the leper, Jesus is saying, may I cleanse you? And his hand is on the leper. And the leper is holding a scroll that goes right down to a very distinct psilocybin mushroom. Huh. And he's saying, Master, cleanse me. So even there, we believe the artist is trying to tell us that these psychoactive plants were used in healing.
Jerry, tell me, what do you think the purpose was for them to illustrate and use these psychedelic mushrooms? What was the goal here?
Well, I think the goal was, and in all of these cultures, whether it be the Greek Eleusinian mysteries, where the use of a hallucinogen, an ergot, was used for 2,000 years uninterrupted. I mean, Plato participated there, Socrates participated there, all of the luminaries of ancient Greece. But it was a secret. You could not talk about it upon pain of death. So this is the Holy of the Holies. This was the original, authentic religious experience, and people treated it in a sacred way, and it was done in secrecy. Secrecy is not suppression, but it meant that for the initiates, for the disciples, this knowledge was available. It was not to be revealed to the masses, and this is why we believe Jesus would say to the disciples, you know, for you, I have one message, but for them, I speak in parables. I have a different message. You will hear what I have to say. So we believe the artists are making a direct link between these psychoactive substances, which are known both historically in ancient cultures and many of them to give direct access to the divine. I would like to emphasize, we're not talking about drugs here in the way we think about drugs today. We're not talking about addictive substances such as cocaine. We're not talking about heroin. We're talking about a class of substances that we technically call entheogens, chemical substances such as LSD or plant substances such as psilocybin, which generate the divine within. The word entheogen, in, gen, and generate, entheogen, to generate the divine within, from the Greek root words. And in modern experiments, especially an experiment which I'd be happy to talk about called the Miracle of Marsh Chapel, that was conducted in the 1960s among Harvard divinity students. The students who were given the psilocybin, 9 out of 10 of them had a significant experience of the divine.
And it did not hurt them, right?
Oh, it did not hurt them. I mean, these things have gone through toxicity studies, and so they're not toxic and they're not addictive.
Probably safer than pharmaceutical drugs, I bet.
Yes, and that's what's going on today, is that, and there is a new science of psychedelics underway, where these substances are being tested through phase 1, 2, and 3 very rigorously within the medical model to see how they can help reduce anxiety and depression in cancer patients, how they can help people overcome post-traumatic stress disorder. So we know that they have healing properties that are being tested in a medical model today, which is very different from the wild use of these substances that went on in the 1960s.
Did you see the study in the New York Times about the chemical found in these magic mushrooms?
Yes, I absolutely did. And this was a report on research that was done at two universities, at New York University and at Johns Hopkins University. And basically what they found is, let's just pause here. Research into these substances, which were classified under the Controlled Substance Act of 1970 as Schedule 1, it was banned for 40 years. And it's very rare that any society or civilization actually bans research in the way that the Inquisition banned Galileo from talking about research. So now that the veil has been lifted and we're in a period of a psychedelic renaissance or a new science of psychedelics, researchers at these universities, at Johns Hopkins and at New York University, used psilocybin, which is a psychoactive component found in magic mushrooms, to see if it would reduce anxiety and depression among cancer patients, who many of them suffer from depression because of the seriousness of a life-threatening illness. Well, 80% of them had a significant response and transformation from their first dose. And that's very important because regular antidepressants, can take months to work, and then you've got to be on them for a long period of time. So the researchers are very excited about this finding, and this is the reason that this is going through the phase 1, 2, and 3 studies to show the gold standard that this can actually work in wide-scale testing on hundreds of patients in a standardized protocol. That's the very last step before FDA approval to use this as a medicine. And I want to stress here, we're not talking about putting this in a dispensary the way marijuana is being dispensed in Colorado for recreational uses.
Right.
You might think of this more like an anesthetic being dispensed and managed and administered by an anesthesiologist.
What fascinates you the most about this, Jerry?
I'm sorry?
What fascinates you about all of this? Because you sound very into this and excited about it.
Look at it this way. I mean, Julie and I had our first encounters with psychoactive substances back in the 60s and 70s. And then later on, when we started out on this research, our personal experiences merged with our professional interests, mine with religion and anthropology, and Julie's with spirituality and psychotherapy. She's a psychotherapist by training, and she has worked with cancer patients during her practice.
Interesting. Hold on, Jerry. Hold on for a sec. We're going to hit the break. We'll come back and talk more about this, the psychedelic gospels, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Jerry Brown with us, co-author of the book, The Psychedelic Gospels. And Jerry, let's pick up what we were talking about before about these magic mushrooms and the studies. And you're going to mention an experiment as well. Go ahead.
Well, George, I had some time to reflect on your question during the break. And while I am very excited about our research in the psychedelic gospels, which is available on Amazon, and people can also go to our website, psychedelicgospels.com. I'm very excited about our research that's finding that in the roots of Judeo-Christianity, there are mind-expanding plants, magic mushrooms, and other psychoactive substances, similar to the way there have been in ancient India and in ancient Greece. But even as exciting and perhaps more exciting is that they say it's very rare that you get a second chance in life. And psychedelics are getting a second chance within a health-based, compassionate medical model to revisit these substances to see how they can help people. We're seeing they can be helpful with post-traumatic stress syndrome, with addiction, with psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. Marijuana and the oils in it can be helpful in cancer treatment. We're back in the early stages, and even removing the proteins associated building up on the cells with Alzheimer. So there is a psychedelic renaissance underway, and to have this second chance after what happened in the 1960s and 1970s is a very exciting development for anyone who studied this area, because we're going to have the opportunity to test and see how these drugs can be used to help and heal people.
Well, because I remember back in the 60s and 70s, anybody who even mentioned this was considered a hippie or a freak or something like that, and it really got a bad rap, didn't it?
Absolutely, and you know, let's remember that time and the fact that at one point, President Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America. If only that was our most serious problem today, but to recognize it was taboo, we actually banned the research in these substances as Schedule 1 on the Controlled Substances Act. So it was a taboo, and I remember way back to the O.J. Simpson trial, there was this brilliant geneticist who was going to testify, and it came out in the evidence that he had taken LSD, so he was disqualified immediately. I mean,
wow. It
was taboo to come out of the psychedelic closet at that particular time.
I want to get into the out of body. I want to get into the out of body experiences and some other issues, but let's get back to the psychedelic gospels, and then you can mention this experiment that you said was conducted. The fact that it influenced the ancients of that era so much, because in their pictures on your cover, for example, is a drawing of what looks like Christ in mushrooms underneath him. I mean, they really were into this in a big way. How come?
Well, because let's look at it this way. What is the role of these substances in ancient culture? If you believe, as most traditions do, in a life after death, in an invisible heaven or godly world where in paganism the gods and goddesses rule, or in monotheism where there is a divine presence, and you actually find substances, plants that God has put here on earth that will give you access to these a direct personal experience of the divine, then these come to play a very important role and become sacred plants in those societies. In the book, we quote Catholic brother David Stendhal Rost, who is from the Order of St. Benedict, and he says, look, if I can encounter God through a sunrise seen from a mountaintop, why not through a mushroom prayerfully ingested? So we believe that there's no fundamental contradiction between the beauty of Judaism or Catholicism and realizing that these substances can enhance one's direct encounter with the divine presence with God, however you will define that greater power. In fact, in Brazil, where there is a widespread use of ayahuasca in the Church of Santo Dime, this is approved by the bishops of Brazil. So we are not here to challenge or criticize anyone's faith in the religion, but really to reintroduce what has been an ancient tradition that has been visibly documented throughout Christianity, in early Christianity and in medieval churches, and really fell away during the time of the Inquisition.
Now, Jerry, tell us about this experiment you said that had been conducted.
Well, this happened, this is called the Miracle of Marsh Chapel, and it was conducted at Marsh Chapel at Boston University by Walter Pankey, who actually was a graduate student at Harvard under the supervision of Timothy Leary, who had not been thrown out of Harvard yet. And what he did was he took two groups of Harvard Divinity students, and he took a group of 20 Harvard Divinity students. He divided them into two groups, and they went into a small chapel at the bottom of Marsh Chapel on Good Friday. And the Good Friday music and the sermon was being piped into this room. One group was given a dose of psilocybin. The 10 were given a dose of psilocybin.
Mm-hmm.
The other 10 were given niacin, which would make you flushed and make you feel
right.
like you had taken something.
It's vitamin B, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Precisely. 9 out of the 10 students, divinity students, who had been given the psilocybin had a significant mystical religious experience. Houston Smith, who went on to become a professor of religion, said it was the most powerful cosmic homecoming he had ever had. So this was the gold standard. Here you had a controlled study, and 6 months later, the people who took the psilocybin were still saying, this is the most significant experience, or one of the most significant experiences I've ever had in my life. Years later, Rick Doblin, who founded the current Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, that's a mouthful, MAPS.org, which is leading the current medical research, he did a follow-up study, and he found 7 of these students who took the psilocybin like 25 years later, and they still said it was a significant turning point in their lives. And we find this over and over again. For example, in the PTSD studies being conducted, they say this was the most or one of the most significant experiences. These experiences, and I and Julie have experienced this herself, are life-transforming. And so that research, which became the gold standard, which became really where science and religion merged to show on an experimental, controlled level what the ancients knew through the use of psychedelics in multiple cultures, was that this can give you direct access to the divine. And in this skeptical world where many people are atheists, or many people say, well, I'm spiritual but not religious, to recognize that we have an ancient tradition of psychoactive plants that can enhance our mystical and spiritual lives is a very powerful realization.
Now, are these events occurring, or are they imaginary under these influences of the psychedelics? For example, out-of-body experiences, when you think you're talking to someone who may have passed on and they're on the other side, are they real or are they imagined?
Well, that is the big question mark in all of this research. Now, in my own experience, they're very real. And if they're going to be real, if we're going to talk about out-of-body experiences, if we're going to talk about near-death experiences, which have been documented over and over again in the research, especially in a book by Stanislav Grof, When the Impossible Happens, and he is one of the foremost researchers in the world on this particular area. When we're going to talk about this, if we are moving into an area where events are happening that do not fit within in physics and time the way scientists understand them, we have to come up with a different model of explanation. But this is essentially what is going on here. These experiences, channeling, mind over matter, out-of-body experiences, the continuation of consciousness after death, this is different from the scientific worldview that we hold right now. And just as we know that at one time in history, people did not know that radio waves existed, or ultraviolet rays existed, that there is a field of information that is accessible under psychoactive substances and is accessible to people in near-death experiences that challenges our current scientific understanding of the nature of memory and its particular limits. So this is an area that the current research into psychedelics will require us to revisit. So that's what I have to say about that. I mean, Grof came to the conclusion that, look, we're not just highly evolved animals with biological computers embedded in our skulls. We are also fields of consciousness without limits, transcending time, space, matter, and linear causality. And if you think about it, we're bombarded by millions of pieces of information every second. If we had to process all of that consciously, we could not function. So the brain actually serves as a filtering system to filter out information. Obviously, psychedelics, mystical experience, near-death experience, spontaneous out-of-body experience, these open up those doors of perception.
Well, they sure do. Now, the work that you've done, and as you've looked at the many things that you have gotten into, what was your conclusion? Did you have a conclusion about what all this stuff meant?
Yes. Our biggest conclusions were the following. There is indisputable evidence of psychedelic plants in the history and origins of Christianity. If this is true, and also in the Judeo-Christian tradition, because some of these drawings go back to the Garden of Eden, which we can talk about. Some of them are from biblical prophets like Isaiah. So it's not just in Christianity, but we could only address Christianity in this book, and there are many beautiful color photographs that we, Julie, took all of these original photographs that provide the documentation. So our conclusion was, yes, our theory is confirmed, and if this is true, then we put it out to the scientific community to look at this, evaluate it, and confirm it. This is a radical theory. It would require that we now rethink everything we've known about the origins of religion, including the origins of Christianity. And that's saying a great deal. So we've said these discoveries that we made, they have to be taken as seriously, these visual discoveries, as the Nag Hammadi Gnostic Gospels and as the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they should be studied by the international scientific community with the same rigor to validate them. It shouldn't be just Julie and my word, and I invite your readers to look at the photographs in our book which provide the evidence.
They're great.
So that's number one. Number two is obviously political and religious communities have had great difficulties with these powerful psychedelic substances. They were banned in the Garden of Eden, and we believe that the plant at the Garden of Eden was psychoactive mushrooms. We can get into that. They were condemned as instruments of satanic witches during the Inquisition, and they were completely banned in the late 1960s and 1970s. So our conclusion is that we need, this time around, we need to look at these with an open heart and an open mind within a compassionate, health-based medical and scientific model. The last conclusion that we came to is that if indeed these substances, which we absolutely believe, provide a direct pathway for people to experience God as they understand them, then this should be, under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, a right that people ought to be able to explore these psychedelic substances, and that there should be sacred centers where people could go, explore them, have the help or assistance of professionally trained guides, and explore them for personal growth and for religious purposes, in the same way that this is legal in Brazil, in the same way that the Native Americans in our country can use peyote in their ceremonies, and this was approved by the Supreme Court of the United States. So in summary, we put forth the theory of the psychedelic gospels for everyone to look at and evaluate the evidence in our book, The Psychedelic Gospels. Number two, if it is confirmed, then we have to revisit what we've known about early Judaism and Christianity. and see how this integrates into the modern practice. And number three, we call for the legalization of psychedelics to be used in sacred centers so people could explore them for religious purposes.
Tell us the story of Gordon Wasson, the J.P. Morgan banker.
Gordon Wasson. Is it pronounced Wasson?
Okay.
Yeah, he is really the father of ethnobotany, the modern study of the, really I should say ethnomycology, the way that different cultures use mushrooms. And as a banker, he became an amateur mycologist, a person who studied mushrooms out of a honeymoon conversation with his Russian-born wife, Valentina, where she loved mushrooms, and he came from our Anglo-Saxon tradition where you had negative feelings and taboos. These were, in Shakespeare, toadstools, things of the underworld, associated poisonous toadstools. And they went out and they found, and Wasson particularly, that the enigmatic soma plant at the heart of the Hindu Rig Veda, one of the world's oldest religious texts, a masterpiece of civilization written down in the Sanskrit some 3,500 years ago, is in praise of soma. And soma, Wasson discovered, was the psychoactive Amanita mushroom, the one we see associated with Santa Claus, fairies, and elves in,
that's right,
in Scandinavian.
Santa was a magic mushroom, right?
Yes. Wasson then teamed up with Albert Hofmann, who first synthesized LSD in his laboratory, Sandoz Labs, in Switzerland in 1938, and a classical Greek scholar, and they broke the code of the Eleusinian mysteries. What was the potion taken at the archaeological site of Eleusis, 14 kilometers outside of Athens, for 2,000 years from 1500 B.C., to 400 A.D., when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and it was destroyed, Eleusis was destroyed, there was a secret sacred potion that any Greek who had not committed murder could go and participate in that ceremony that would enrich his life and give him confidence in the afterlife. And they found it was a psychoactive substance, a fungi called Claviceps purpurea, and they broke the code of the Eleusinian mysteries. Wasson discovered the use of soma, or this Amanita muscaria, among the reindeer herders of Siberia. Reindeer love these mushrooms. And the Siberian reindeer herders, who are considered the fathers of shamanism, they've been using the psychoactive Amanita muscaria since time immemorial.
No wonder Rudolph had a red nose, right?
Exactly. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer. And we believe that all of our modern images of Santa Claus come from the Siberian reindeer herders and the use of Amanita. And Wasson then went on and found a living mushroom cult among the Mazatec Indians of Oaxaca in Mexico.
Hold on, Jerry. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back. We'll talk more. And we'll also open up the phone lines as we talk about the psychedelic gospels.